Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome to the Stock Club podcast, coming to you from the top floor of my Wall Street HQ here in Dublin, Ireland. In this week's episode, we're going to talk about Amazon cancelling their plans for HQ2 in New York, YouTube's algorithm problem, and we're going to pitch the companies that we believe will become 10-baggers over the next few years. So, with me here today is Rory and Maeve.
Hello.
Hello.
No Emma today.
No Emma today. This might be a very short podcast.
Get away with whatever we want to say.
So, first of all, I want to kick off with some of the most recent news stories from the past 2 weeks. And I think we have to talk about Amazon first. So, as you all probably know, last week, Amazon cancelled its plans to open its expansive new corporate campus in Long Island City, New York. The company had initially announced plans to open this 4 million square foot site last November in tandem with another headquarters in Crystal City in Virginia, I think it's called. Yeah, but last week, after facing unexpected backlash from a lot of lawmakers, activists, union leaders and locals over the plans, tech giant suddenly announced that they were pulling the plug on it. A lot of the criticism came about the nearly $3 billion in incentives Amazon was getting for opening the site in Long Island City. Just a quick breakdown of incentives, guys. A lot of numbers coming at you here, so try to pay attention. So Amazon would receive almost $900 million in the city's relocation and employment assistance program, nearly $400 million in the industrial and commercial abatement program. And then in addition to this, they would get $505 million in a capital grant and $1.2 billion in Excelsior job program credits if the job creation goals they promised were met. So that would have totaled about $3 billion, and that would have worked out at about $48,000 per job Amazon was going to provide. They were getting in subsidies. So a lot of money. But then on the flip side of that, according to the state of New York, Amazon would have generated $27.5 billion in state and city revenue over the next 25 years had they opened this site. This was predicated on the assumption that Amazon would have created 25,000 jobs over the next decade, with 40,000 overall on an average salary of $150,000. And then there was obviously construction jobs and other indirect jobs linked to that too. So, you know, it's kind of very two sides of the coin on this. But yeah, it's a big turnaround for Amazon.
I think just optically it looks terrible.
Yeah.
I think the whole thing, the whole Willy Wonka-esque golden ticket contest for where they were going to get their HQ2, whatever that means, was just a bit silly to begin with.
It was a little embarrassing, wasn't it, for some cities?
Well, it's just going to, like, it's never going to go down well when people are like, the city is going to give the richest man in the world, who runs the most valuable company in the world, $3 billion. You know, yeah. Like, that's just never going to sit well with people.
Yeah.
And yeah, the whole, like, it, the thing is, I think it was just a bit of a farce, the entire thing, because, like, the idea that Amazon are going to, like, what, pull out of New York completely, not be in New York, they're going to be building in New York, in New Jersey, and all those surrounding areas, because they're expanding rapidly. And this idea that it was, like, just because it was the HQ2, that means that they get all these tax incentives and you know, a helipad that was specially built for Jeff Bezos to fly in for. Like, it's just ridiculous.
There was a lot of talk about that helipad.
I think we talked about it the last time, or maybe two podcasts ago. And, you know, I think I was given out about it, and Emmett fairly pointed out that Bezos was not going to hop on the subway, do you know? So
that, like, loads of CEOs of banks and major corporations just, you know, have a private car drive them to their headquarters.
Yes.
Yeah, I still maintain that it's a little over the top, Bezos. But yeah, my reaction, first of all, was that it was huge news. And then well, now I'm kind of more where Rory just outlined, which is it's all a bit of a game show, really.
Yeah.
Like, I think they obviously are, you just said this, but they're obviously going to go into New York, and maybe HQ2 will be there. It's just in 6 months they'll announce that it's in a different part of the city.
But, like, HQ2 just, it doesn't even mean anything, you know? Yeah. It's like, it's not a protected term, headquarter. It doesn't mean, you know, like, it's just going to be, they're going to have offices in New York. Of course they are.
Yeah.
And they need to have, you know, infrastructure in the biggest metropolis in the world. So, yeah, this whole thing where it was going to be their HQ2 just sounds silly. And I'll just point out, someone pointed out online, I can't remember where I read this in an article, but you had all these municipalities bidding for this headquarters.
Yeah.
And all of them were, you know, bending over backwards to try and get this contract. And in the process, they all handed over all their plans for the next 10, 20 years. So Amazon now has all this data for basically every major city in America. And they're going to, like, use that for their expansion plans. So
it was all just a data collecting exercise.
I mean, like, if it was, it was both tricky and genius, but
tinfoil hats on. But Amazon actually said very little about the decision, though. Their statement pulling out of New York was only 363 words long. They've said nothing since, but very tellingly, I'm just going to read out an extract from this statement, which I think is very telling about the kind of overall climate about this decision. While polls show that 70% of New Yorkers support our plans and investment, a number of state and local politicians have made it clear that they oppose our presence and will not work with us to build the type of relationship that are required to go forward with the project we and many other envisioned in Long Island City. So they're really kind of hanging local representatives out to dry in this statement. And there was a big kickback from people like the new Democratic representative, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and other kind of more local activists about, you know, what I suppose they feared was essentially the gentrification of that Long Island site.
Yeah, I mean, like that, you know, she's, you know, to the left of many politicians, and she positions herself as a person of the people. I don't think she had as much a hand in it as kind of the more state senators and councilmen. But look, that's she's not happy with a major corporation receiving $3 billion. her argument is that if you're the biggest company in the world and you're making billions of dollars in revenue, hundreds of billions of dollars in revenue, you should be giving money back to the community, not taking it out of the community. So,
yeah.
And, you know, there's going to be problems with rent increases and, you know, people who live in Long Island City or
Probably not going to be the people working in this HQ2.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. That's exactly it. And they're going to be forced out, or they're going to see, you know, increased costs of living. The people I really feel for are the realtors, because I think a lot of them started buying property very quickly once that announcement was made, and they're not going to be making what they thought they were going to be making.
Sitting on a lot of empty apartments at the moment. So moving on then, Maeve, is there any stories you were looking at over the last 2 weeks?
There is, and it's not good news, I'm sorry.
Oh, great.
It's not a light news topic today. I'm going to talk about some governance issues that YouTube has been facing as a platform recently.
Okay.
So I think we've talked about this internally in the office before. Sometimes you can end up in a very weird place in YouTube. I know I end up there sometimes and I can't remember how I got there.
A YouTube hole,
exactly. But shout out to my dad, who sent me a video this week. It's a TED talk by a guy called James Bridle. He is a British artist and writer, and the TED talk is about the nightmares of YouTube for kids.
Okay.
And there is a number of kind of dark strands when it comes to kids consuming YouTube. And the one I'm going to talk about today is the really weird one, which is that kids are obsessed with these surprise egg videos. Any parents listening will probably know what I mean. It's the concept of a Kinder Egg. So you unbox the egg and there's some kind of lovely little toy inside.
Okay.
And apparently what kids do these days is they sit and they watch surprise egg after surprise egg video for possibly hours. And what's happening is, because of the algorithms on YouTube and because of the autoplay function, and mostly because there's evil people out there generating kind of malicious and explicit content, within about a dozen clicks, you can get from a surprise egg video to something horrible.
Okay.
And in his TED talk, he kind of outlines the effects that this is having on kids. And I'm just going to read a very small excerpt from James Bridle's transcript. So He says that this is what happens when all of these different keywords, all of these different pieces of attention and this desperate generation of content all comes together in a single place. And this stuff really, really does affect small children. Parents have reported their children being traumatised, becoming afraid of the dark, becoming afraid of their favourite cartoon characters. If you take one thing away from this TED Talk, it's that if you have small children, keep them the hell away from YouTube.
Pretty definitive statement there.
He goes really strong and firm on it, and if you watch the TED Talk or if you do your own research into this, you'll understand why.
Yeah.
So like, just to make sure I'm painting the right type of picture, this 12th click might get to a video where Peppa Pig is bouncing happily along a street and then in 30 or 60 seconds she's blown to smithereens. So pretty evil stuff.
Pretty bad.
And it's all to do with, well, James Bridle's theory, and from my reading, is the fact that, you know, some very well known platforms are hacking the brains of small children to advertise on YouTube for ad revenue.
Yeah.
And it comes down to that. That's the bottom line.
Yeah.
And there was some news this week, a number of pieces of news about how people are starting to push back. Rory, I think you mentioned in our preamble to starting to record that you knew of some platforms that pulled away from YouTube.
Yeah, I mean, that was based on another story, which is slightly related to this, but that's similarly dark anyway, which was a video by, I think his name was Matt Watson. Did you share it with us? It was, he'd kind of gone through a wormhole, or he'd gone through the recommendation system in YouTube and found some very explicit content with kids in it, and the algorithm wasn't kind of hiding this. What actually was most disturbing was YouTube knew about this because they were disabling comments on a lot of the videos, but they weren't doing anything else to hide this content. And it ended up with ads from Disney in particular, was one of the biggest companies that ended up having a paid for ad on one of these videos.
Okay.
And so Disney this week have announced they're stopping all advertising on YouTube for the moment. I think Nestle as well have said they're not going to be advertising on them for a while. And yeah, it's just, you know, it's another signal that any site that has user generated content, particularly stuff that's aimed at children or minors, has to be so careful, and they're just not.
Well, the vetting, like, so that is, you're right, that's a slightly different issue, but it is the same kind of crux, which is that why isn't the vetting and the reporting of this more robust? You know, like, if there is millions of ad revenue to be generated, would both parties not have, I suppose, a moral responsibility to try and make sure that they're not traumatizing or abusing kids?
It's kind of just the latest chapter for YouTube, though. You know, like, as an arm of the world's biggest advertiser, aka Google, like, this isn't the first time they've gotten in trouble for having, you know, I think it was maybe a year ago, was it, that a lot of major brands pulled their ads from YouTube again because it was featuring next to extremist content, or their ads were featuring for extremist content. And it's just, as you said, with a user generated platform like that, they're not doing a very good job at policing it.
No, they're not. I mean, look, you can see this across any business that relies on user generated content. All you need to do is go to the comments section of any kind of major publication.
It's the bottom half of the internet.
It can be awful, and we've seen, you know, Facebook obviously has this issue. Reddit got in trouble a couple of years ago with various kind of subreddits that they were hosting. It's just you're seeing a real lack of kind of corporate responsibility on the part of particularly companies the size of Google and Facebook, who really should be putting some money aside to protect the platform for the sake of their business long term as well. I mean, like, it's not just it's very short term thinking on their part that if they have this kind of content on there, advertisers are going to flee. You know, Disney is not going to have its brands associated with this kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's it for me. Like, when I heard that Peppa Pig was being blown up and that kids were getting nightmares, it affected me, and I had the same thought as you, Rory. Like, should there not be meaningful corporate responsibility there? Money pumped into it, teams formed, and the issue addressed. So, not a happy news story, but an interesting one.
So to end on that bright note,
we're going to move on. YouTube basically is the
sorry, parents.
Yeah.
Next we're going to move on to the company we never talk about. Rory, as Emmett's not here this week, it's your turn. What company do you want to delve a little bit more into today?
I'm going to talk about a company that we talk about so little that sometimes I actually forget it's in the showroom. Always on the ball. Well, it's a company that we in Ireland definitely don't get a lot of experience of, and that's Lululemon.
Okay.
So Lululemon, yoga, apparel manufacturer, it's specialised retail. I don't even think we have a store here. I think they have a concession in one of the major department stores, but they don't have a dedicated retail store. But Lululemon is a specialised retailer, a very tough industry. and, you know, selling very expensive, high quality yoga gear.
About $100 of leggings.
Yeah. I went into a store in New York last time I was over, and I saw a very nice grey hoodie, and it was about $140, which is expensive for a hoodie. But in terms of the company, like, you would have thought a company that was selling this kind of gear for that kind of price would really have been attacked by the big players like Nike and Under Armour and Adidas, and that would have squeezed them. Well, actually, they haven't been successful at all. Lululemon has the best gross margins in the industry. They're up in the mid-50s. They've got double-digit same-store sales growth since 2010. And I think what they've been very good at is they didn't fall into the trap that other businesses in the industry fell into, which is that they kept really tight controls on their distribution channels.
Yeah.
So it's nearly all direct to customers. It's nearly all sold through Lululemon stores or digital. So while Nike and Under Armour and Adidas were all trying to recover from third-party bankruptcies in the States last year, all the big sports retailers, Lulu wasn't really affected. So we added Nike, Under Armour and Lululemon to the app all at the same time. They were the original stocks in the showroom. Lululemon's up 171% since we added it. That's against Nike, which is at 53%, and Under Armour, which is actually down 50%. So at the moment,
the best overall retailer.
Oh, I would think so, yeah, in terms of like actual retailer, not kind of e-commerce retailer.
Yeah.
At the moment, it's trading at a very high valuation. It's about 6x sales versus it's about half of that for Nike and even less of that for Under Armour. But I mean, they have those market leading margins. They've got a really loyal customer base. They've got a really good online presence, especially on kind of Instagram and stuff like that. Maybe you pointed out.
I have a few people in my life who are, you know, fit, fair play to them. And they are
no
female.
One in this room.
Well, hang on, there's a caveat. They are female. And they tend to really want to show the Lululemon clothing that they buy, particularly the kind of women's workwear tops. They have kind of really intricate straps in the back.
Yeah.
Very Instagrammable. And I think there's 2.5 million posts with those tops tagged as Lululemon on Insta today.
That might lead into, Rory, the point you mentioned there about how expensive these clothes are. Like, it was Under Armour's, one of their big faults over the past few years was the discounting they allowed on their brand. Yeah. It really destroyed their brand, which they still haven't recovered from in North America. You know, if they're charging $140 for a top, someone posts on Instagram, you know how much they pay for it.
Yeah, and that's a really good point. You know, there's always going to be a business in turning commodities into luxury items. And you just need to look at someone like Starbucks or Nespresso, who did that with coffee. Haagen-Dazs, who did it with ice cream. You know, it's making something, turning something into a high-value product but through brand is a tough but good way to make money if you do it right.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's Lululemon, one of the companies we never talk about.
Never talk about. So moving on from that then, Rory, you're going to talk again.
Because
going back to one of our most popular segments in the last year, which was I Read a Book. This is where one of us recommend a book that we read recently that helped us to think a little bit differently about our investing life. Rory, the book you're going to talk about today, I believe, is also the subject of the most recent expert opinion piece in the app.
Yeah, if you've read the expert opinion piece, you might be tired of hearing about this book, or because I've been talking about it a lot recently. But yeah, it's a book I just finished reading recently. It's called Thinking in Bets, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Have All the Facts, and it's by Annie Duke. And Annie Duke, if anyone doesn't know, she's a World Series of Poker bracelet winner.
Yeah.
Female poker player in a very male-dominated sport. And she's now a professional speaker and a decision strategist.
Okay.
And so this book is basically, as the title suggests, she's trying to break down how people make decisions and poses some kind of exercises in which to help us make better decisions.
Okay.
And she starts the book in a really interesting way. She talks about the Super Bowl in 2015, where the Seattle Seahawks were down about 4 points with about 26 seconds left. And everyone in the world who was watching this, me included, thought they were going to just try and run the ball over the 1 yard line, which would have won them the game, won them the championship. And instead, the coach called a pass play, which got intercepted, and they lost the game. Mm. And it's been referred to many times as the worst call in football history, the worst call in Super Bowl history. But actually, if you look into the call, into the decision the coach made, it was actually a brilliant decision.
And,
you can read the EOP to find out why it was a brilliant decision. But basically, all the stats pointed to that being the best thing he could do.
Yeah.
But it's still called the worst decision ever. And the reason she points out it was called the worst decision ever is because it didn't work. And so that's what poker players call resulting. And resulting is when you judge how good a decision was based on the outcome.
Okay.
Which is a very dangerous thing to do.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the times, a lot of the times we make really good decisions and bad things end up happening.
Yeah. External forces.
External forces come into play. And a lot of the time we make really bad decisions and good things happen.
Is that luck?
Yeah. So, I mean, like you can, you know, if you wanted to, you could drive straight through a red light. The fact that you don't get hit by a car doesn't make it a bad decision. Make it a good decision. Sorry. Okay, excuse me. So that was one of the first things she points out, and I thought that was really important in terms of an investing point of view, because a lot of the times we can make decisions that might have been good decisions at the time and they don't end up working out, and we start to question if we made a good decision or a bad decision. And a lot of the times we can make bad decisions. We can invest, you know, without doing all our research, without doing our due diligence, and we can end up making money. And, you know, if we were to use resulting, we would think that was a good decision. We might continue those practices going forward. So I thought that was a very interesting take on things. She also delves into how to make better decisions in terms of truth seeking. And when she says truth seeking, she means going out and finding all the facts. And not just the facts you want to hear, you know, confirmation bias and so forth. Yeah. Facts that you don't want to hear. So the opposite opinion, basically. Okay. And
which humans are not very good at doing.
No, we're not. We're really not. And it's very hard in the world of investing as well, because you find a lot of the time the arguments aren't exactly high level.
Yeah.
On the message boards you go onto,
we're getting back to the comment sections.
Yeah, exactly. It's genuinely you're an idiot for investing in that stock. That's that's like the most.
And you tell them you're basing that on my outcome, not my decision.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I won't go too deep into it. I think it's a great book. It really opened my eyes to the way people make decisions and the way we evaluate our own decision-making abilities. And anyone who wants to become a better decision-maker, a better investor, I think it's a really good book to pick up.
Yeah, it's very interesting, because it's such a hard thing to, I suppose, quantify, like the process in making a decision. It's hard to measure that, whereas, you know, the result, if it works out or it doesn't, you can easily measure that, but it's kind of, it's asking you to do a little bit more work.
Yeah, and I think where she's coming from in terms of, so she talks a lot about poker in the book, and poker is, anyone who plays poker knows that in an average game, you're going to be ending to make hundreds of decisions very quickly, and you kind of get instant feedback.
Yeah.
So that we rarely get that in our lives. It's rare that you can kind of say one decision led to this outcome. It's usually a lot of different decisions, and a lot of different things have to fall in place for things to work out the way you want to. But it's more about kind of what I think she's trying to say is, if you build a kind of knowledge base that's based on facts and get into models of trying to figure out all the facts before you make a decision, you're going to make better decisions throughout your life.
Emma talked about Wynn Resorts in the last episode, and you're talking about poker now. I think all the signs are pointing towards a casino.
Yeah, working holiday.
Working holiday.
Yeah.
Does she cover luck and timing?
She talks about luck a lot, but I mean, luck is one of the things she points out is totally outside her control. So, you know, I think the overarching theme of the book is that if you can make better decisions, you're going to get better luck in the long run.
So do better and kind of you'll feel luckier.
Yeah. Or just like if you have a foundation of truth that you base your beliefs and your decision making on, you'll tend to get better outcomes. So you're basically trying to stack the odds in your favour.
Okay. Yeah, because I think it's an Irish thing, but like one or two decisions in my life that ended up going well for me, I always kind of add, oh, well, look, it was luck and timing, you know, like when really what I should say is I made the right call there. You know?
You diminish your responsibility.
Well, I remember like a lot of times people ask us based on our results, you know, how much do you attribute this to luck? And we all kind of slink backwards.
No one really wants to give the number or the quant on that,
do they? It was all our skill.
The Homer Simpson gif of him going back in. So that was, I read a book, and that book again, Rory, is?
It's called Thinking in Bets, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Have All the Facts, by Annie Duke.
Yeah, and that expert opinion piece is live in the My Wall Street app at the moment. We're going to move on to the last part now, and Maeve, I'm going to let you take it from here.
Okay, we are moving into the elevator pitch. This week it is going to be James and Rory pitching, and I'll remind you that an elevator ride takes between 30 and 60 seconds depending on what part of the world you're in.
Unless you're Emmett Savage.
Our fearless leader isn't here. He takes very long elevator rides.
Well, look, if the content is interesting, I'll stay in the lift. But okay, and I think the theme this week is the stock that you guys both believe has the potential to be a 10-bagger at some stage in the future.
Yeah. I love this. I love when we do these, because it really does make you focus on a lot of things, because not many companies are going to turn out to be 10 baggers. So you really do need to narrow your perimeters when you're searching for them. So
I'm going to go first, because this is my first time doing an elevator pitch.
Let's do it.
So the company I've picked is Teladoc. So Teladoc is a telemedicine company that uses telephone and video conferencing technology to provide on-demand remote medical care via mobile devices. That's their description, but the company, I think, is really interesting, really excited about it. So like most of the companies in our showroom, it was beaten down towards the end of last year. But even in spite of this, it's still returned an impressive 95% since we added it to My Wall Street a little over a year ago. It's only valued at $5 billion, and I think it's a long road left to run. It has huge clients, including ExxonMobil, Google, Microsoft, Coca-Cola, Facebook, about 40% of Fortune 500 companies, in fact. And it already has a huge head start in competitors, with its footprint extending from Shanghai to Dubai to Dallas. But what we're really seeing in relation to Teladoc is the gradual customer adoption of the platform. While it has all these large corporate clients, its gradual adoption across the actual employees of these clients will really help the company. In its last earnings call, paid membership increased by 18% year on year to hit 22.6 million. Total visits grew 110% from the year before to hit 641,000. As long-term investors, we should always ask, can we imagine a company thriving in 10 years? Given current inefficiencies in the global healthcare system, plus the increasing move of services to mobile and integrated providers, I can say with near certainty that Teladoc will have a major role in the future. It's one of the biggest holdings in my portfolio, and I'm going to add more soon.
Okay.
Finn.
I love Teladoc.
Yeah.
It's one of the ones I was kind of looking at for this.
Yeah, it's just making something that will never go away, which is, you know, getting access to healthcare. It's just making it so easy. You know, you don't have to take a day off work to
Absolutely.
Go to the doctor.
Yeah,
good one. Me.
That was a good pitch.
You seem rattled, Rory.
Gosh, yeah, I know.
What's going to happen here? We're coming back down in the lift now, so be mindful.
Okay. The company I'm going to pitch is a really recent addition to your showroom. It's called Eventbrite. Anyone who doesn't know, they're kind of like a mini Ticketmaster. They kind of focus on events that would be not the same size as Ticketmaster. So you're not talking about the big stadium gigs. You're talking about kind of more smaller gigs, smaller events organized by not massive corporations, usually kind of small independent event organizers, or even just people who want to set up an event.
Yeah.
It's a $2.3 billion business. I think they've established themselves really well in the space. They're targeting a really underserved customer base. I think they have a strong brand, definitely in terms of lowering search costs. You know, I worked in marketing and events for years, and they're definitely the first name that jumped to mind when you thought of ticketing at that level, at that price point. They've got a founder CEO with high insider ownership. It's actually a married couple who started the business, and they were involved in a company a few years ago called Zoom, which was acquired by PayPal right before we were going to add it to the showroom, unfortunately. And they've got really strong retention amongst their customer base at 97% in the last quarter. So I think going forward, you know, you're going to see some competition. A lot of companies are trying to get into the experience space, Airbnb, TripAdvisor, all kind of pivoting that way. But I like Eventbrite very much. I've used them as a customer, and I thought their system was really seamless. I know people who've used them as organizers, and they really love it. And finally, my man Jason Moser is a big fan, so that's always a good sign when investing in a company. So that's my pitch.
Sounds good.
Okay, they were good pitches.
Decision's up to you, Maeve.
Well, this is a funny one because I own both.
Hey.
And they're two of my more preferred stocks in our app. I'm going to go with Eventbrite, and I'll tell you why. It's because I've used it, and also because I am biased. There was a recent Masters of Scale with Reid Hoffman and Julia Hartz, who is the current CEO and the wife of the other founder of Eventbrite, Kevin.
Yes.
And I got a really good vibe off her. She's kind of the same modus operandi as me, which is if you don't start with your customer, you're not going to build a billion-dollar business. So it's Eventbrite for
me.
Yeah.
Giles?
But that was an enjoyable
I want a second opinion.
No, Giles, we don't have a tiebreaker. Okay, Giles, go on, vote there. Give us a circle for Rory and a thumbs up for James. We actually can't hear you.
Ah, yes.
Even Stevens.
We'll get him at the pick next week. So that's about it from us here at Stock Club this week. And if you have anything that you want us to discuss on the next podcast, make sure to leave a comment or email us at pod@mywallstreet.com. That's POD@mywallstreet.com. As always, there's plenty of new things to check out in the My Wall Street app at the moment too, including that expert opinion piece that Rory talked about earlier. You can actually listen to all the past episodes of the Stock Club podcast in the My Wall Street app too. Simply find it in the featured section of the Focus tab. Thanks for listening in today, and please make sure to rate, review and share the podcast if you enjoyed it. From myself, from Rory, from Maeve, see you in 2 weeks.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.